ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
A body on the train tracks in mysterious circumstances.
Mark's been found on railway tracks.
An award-winning ABC podcast and a fresh inquest underway.
Every time we walk out of that inquest, just being like, oh my God.
You weren't out there on the train tracks that night?
Absolutely not.
As the answers get closer, the podcast is back.
He said he's guilty. He's guilty as sin.
Search for Unravel Blood on the Tracks. It's on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, dear reader. It's Claire Nichols here, and get your bonnets ready because we are celebrating 250 years of Jane Austen today on The Book Show. Yes, we're toasting Jane Austen's 250th birthday with a brand new series here on The Book Show. It's going to be a delight, and you're going to hear the first instalment soon. You're also going to hear from Marcus Zusak later in the show. But first, a question. Can you write a masterpiece about being confused? Patricia Lockwood is here. She's known for her memoir, Priest Daddy, and the novel No One Is Talking About This, which was one of my favourite reads of 2021. That novel was shortlisted for the Booker Prize, and it was really remarkable in how quickly it turned from laugh out loud funny to cry out loud devastating. It happened in just a couple of pages. It was inspired by Patricia's real life and the tragic death of her baby niece. Now Patricia has a new book, and again, it is inspired by her own story, specifically her experience of long COVID and what it did to her mind. The book is called Will There Ever Be Another You? Hi, Patricia.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
This is a bit of a loaded question to start with. How are you?
I am so good. I'm sitting in a hotel room in London. I was able to have an espresso this morning. I actually feel perfect. I feel like myself.
And how long has it been since you felt like yourself?
Oh my goodness. It was really quite a long time. When people look at the time frame, it's really rather shocking. It started in 2020 and we're all the way in 2025. Is that accurate? I don't want to admit that much time has passed, but that's true, right? It's 2025.
Yeah.
So it's been quite a while. I was sort of in the wilderness of the illness, I would say, for about 4 years, and did come out of it about a year ago and am feeling much better now, yes.
Oh, I'm so pleased to hear that because I know certainly the last time we spoke, you were really in the throes of it still.
Oh, goodness. Yeah. Was it one of those interviews where I ate like an entire like $27 worth of Wendy's before I did
That's
it?
Right. I remember you
it
did.
Was. Oh, my goodness. This is amazing. I can't believe I remember that. I was like speaking to you and I was like, yeah, I just ordered $27 worth of Wendy's.
And I always think of you for eating things because I remember when you were shortlisted for the Booker for that novel, you made that video where you kind of had an egg pop out of your mouth and you said that that's what being shortlisted for the Booker felt like.
I know. They're always like, what is this like crazy? What is this experience? Tell me what that's like. And I'm like, I can only describe it in weird ways. So they're like, make a short video. And I was like, well, I have this crystal egg. Why don't I put it in my mouth and slowly draw it out as a surprise while holding it up to the camera? And I was like, what are they going to do with that, right? But actually, that is a triumphant tale because that's pure me. That's like classic me to put, you know, a crystal egg in my mouth and pop it out. I should have known at that point I was going to be okay.
Yeah, you were still there somewhere.
Somewhere inside.
Okay, well, let's talk about, I want to start with the title of the book.
Okay, yeah.
Will There Ever Be Another You? Tell me where that comes from.
So it's actually, I stole this. I lifted this wholesale. It literally was the Time magazine headline on that cover where the clone sheep is like staring at the audience, you know, and it's Dolly. That's the line. Will there ever be another you? I actually did see that in an antique mall. And I was like, I'm taking that. That's mine.
And what was it about that title that spoke to you in regards to this particular book?
I think I felt that it was very poetic on its own. I think one of the things you might notice in the book is there are a lot of like repeated sentences that she sort of hears them and gets them on a loop in her mind. And they're sort of just working in there like music. And like, why is she thinking these things? Why is she, you know, why is this going on in her brain? But I really think it was that sort of like lyricism, that ability to recognize a sentence that had greater utility than just its surface meaning. So she sees that and she's like, will there ever be another you? That's not just about a sheep. That's about me.
Yeah, and as we've kind of ascertained, you were in this really difficult place.
Yeah, it's the Wendy's. Yeah.
But, I mean, even before that, can we go back to when you first got COVID? What did you notice at the start? What changes did you notice in yourself when you got sick?
I would say there was about a 6-week period where things felt okay. They felt pretty normal. And then I remember going to the beach on my birthday and someone messaged me a question and I was trying to formulate an answer to this question. And I realized that what I was writing down didn't make any sense at all. And I was like, wait a minute, what's going on? And from there, I sort of went more out of the world. Like I had a lot of physical sensations that I didn't actually record. I don't talk about the pain as much. I don't, you know, you talk about the fevers, but I was really more interested in like the mental changes, the inability to speak at times, to read, these things that like feel so crucial to your sense of self. Certainly if you're a writer, you're like, if those things go away, if I lose my ability to read books and write about books and think and speak about books, what am I? It's my job is to read books and write books and to think about things. If that goes away, what does that mean for me as a person?
And you know, you were saying you were struggling to read, you were struggling to write, but you were writing things down, right?
I know. Yes, I was. And that's the interesting part, right? So while I'm at my sickest, I'm still writing like an essay about Nabokov. Why am I doing that, right? Why am I filling page after page with like, you know, the document of my experience? I was still a writer. I understood that somewhere inside. I was still trying to sort of write about this experience, figure out what was going on, keep it alive, right? So no one wanted to like write about these things. No one wanted to write about COVID. No one wanted to think about it. Any of that pandemic time. And the entire time, it's my most extensively documented period because I was like, well, what's going on? What's happened to me? What's happened to the world? How do you traditionally like ask these questions and think about these things? You write about them.
Was it weird to go back and look at those notebooks and see just where you were mentally?
Absolutely. There was one period, and I think it's when I was working on Elena Ferrante, which is very funny, that I was writing all of my notes in this neon orange pen that was completely unreadable. And I go back now and I'm like, what was she doing? Like, what is this poor person suffering that she's using this fluorescent orange pen?
So the difficulty, I guess, in talking about this book, Patricia, Will There Ever Be Another You, is it's not a memoir, but it's kind of a memoir. Like,
it's a little bit of memoir.
I mean, how close is it and how fun is it to blur that line?
Yeah, it is. I do like to do that because, you know, pre-study, I was very scrupulous. There's nothing in there that is not true. You know, there's like a little bit of like stylization of some of the conversations, but that's about it. Then I go into No One Is Talking About This, and it's if I allow that to be fiction, I'm able to be more honest about this experience. I'm a little bit less scared about putting things in that I might not put in if I'm calling it memoir. And by the time I get to this, it's almost playful, right? Mm-hmm. It's like, well, why do we think about these things this way? There are historical categories that I do think fit, like a fictionalized autobiography, like an autobiographical novel. I think those things work. But when you tell yourself it's fiction, you're able to do things, I think, in form. You're able to think more bravely because you're not strictly thinking along the lines of truth. But I did want to do something here where it was just like all the perceptions in the book were true. You know, if I'm saying she's seeing a rainbow, she's glimpsing a gorilla in the trees, that's going to be true. If I put that in, I think that I can convey what the state is like. I think I can show that to people. You can mess around with timelines, you can fictionalize other things, but I really wanted to to get that down actually as it was. Mm. I should have put in about the Wendy's. That is actually perfect. I missed a shot there.
You can save that for the next one. Because I do think, you know, going from the memoir Priest Daddy into No One Is Talking About This, the novel, you know, very closely based on your own experience, and then into this one, you can read them as a sort of trilogy, right? Like, we're getting to know you, we're getting to know your husband, we're getting to know your mum and dad, we're getting to know your sister. And I think there's a richer reward there, right, in reading them all together.
Yes, and actually that is very insightful of you, because at some point Jason actually was looking at this. He's like, do you know you've written a trilogy? Are you aware? And I was like, oh, hey. And I told my publisher, I was like, hey, we could call it a trilogy. She's like, everybody hates trilogies. Never call it that.
Yeah, real literary writers don't write trilogies, do they?
Yeah, she's like, it's not a trilogy, but it is. It is three volumes about my life. And as people have been pointing out recently as well, you know, they're all about illness, or they're shaped by illness in some way. You know, the reason we had to move back in with my parents is because my husband developed these cataracts. So looking at that, it's quite an unusual document as well. You're talking about things that happen outside of your control. Certainly, and No One Is Talking About This, you can't control, you know, whether a baby is born with a chromosomal deletion. That's out of our hands. And then you get to the end, and there's kind of like a practical arc to the book where it's like, toward the end of it, how do you get well? What are the things you can do? Is there something to be said for caring for other people? Can that take you out of yourself? Can that also return you to the world? It happened once before, you know, in the way that I cared for my niece. That returned me to the world. And I think that showed me something with this book as well, that that might be the way through here also.
I did appreciate that the story of your niece continued through this book, because, it's obviously something that moved so many readers, and we cared so deeply about that relationship. What I found really moving about this book is that the grief may change, but it doesn't go away. Right?
No, it's
always there.
Mm-hmm.
And your sister, there's a scene where she loses her phone that she took all the photos of her daughter with.
Yes.
And even though you know that they're probably backed up in a cloud somewhere, there's something devastating about that.
I know. And so No One Is Talking About This ends with the loss of a phone, and this book begins with the loss of a phone. And there is something about the fact that that physical object was with you in that hospital room, that this is the actual rectangle you picked up to take her picture, to take this video. There's just something that can't be replaced about that. And it's true, we did visited the fairy pools. This is all accurate.
This is in Scotland, right?
This is in Scotland, yes. And, you know, she loses her phone, and it was like, oh my gosh, did a hand reach out from like beyond the veil, from beyond, and just pluck this up and take this from her? And I just thought, if I ask, I'm going to ask the fairies to return it, to give it back, because it was too precious. They might have just picked it up thinking it's just another cell phone. No, this was the real one. We need that back. And they gave it back to us.
Wow. And of course, you go from thinking about fairies and changelings to a chapter called Changeling, because we go from Scotland to you starting to get sick. I'm hoping you might read to us, because this is very particular the way you write this. I hope you can read to us from the start of that chapter.
It stole people from themselves. You might look the same to others, but you had been replaced. The first line of the mad notebook read, I wish, when I was a teenage Christian, that I had been more experimental with my evangelizing. God laid a big egg in my heart to tell you this. But please don't write about it. People were already begging each other. So she kept the notebook secret. It was rectangular and aqua, like an Olympic swimming pool through which men with Marfan syndrome glided. No one wants to read about any of this, and so she kept it hidden and wrote everything down and felt long, scissoring strokes when she looked into it, and sometimes a high, deafening dive. She had now had a fever for 48 days. Her head was completely bald because she had asked her husband to shave it, thinking of scenes from old books. Her tongue was purple because she had painted it with something, gentian violet, so that her husband almost screamed when she opened her mouth like a cave at him between kisses. She took wormwood every morning like a witch from the Bible, and had fallen so far out of the world, out of the human population that she could not even rejoin them to watch the butthole cut of cats.
Ah, the butthole cut of cats. No one should forget that the butthole cut of cats, Patricia.
No, never forget the butthole cut of cats.
I also loved a line your narrator says in the book about long COVID. I should mention, you never use the word long COVID. I think you know that that's a word people don't like. You use the word...
I know.
Yeah, so you just say it. It.
It.
It makes your social media posts weird for 1 year. Also, it makes your pubes as soft as a chinchilla.
Yeah, and that is actually true. I was like, I kind of treasured that time. I could have that part again. I love those chinchilla pubes that COVID gave me. But it's true. I think the line after that, like she mentioned this or she posted about this and she was asked to write about it for a women's magazine.
Oh my goodness. How do you, you know, apart from using the word it and avoiding the word COVID, how do you tackle COVID in a book in a time when people don't want to remember this period?
Yeah. Yeah. We really do want to sort of like memory hole it, right? But I was like, you know, there have been post-viral illnesses in the past. This is not unlike other things that have happened to human beings, even after the flu pandemic. You see sort of like documents about this type of thing cropping up. And again, it's just like, if we're going through this, if I'm seeing this in other people, if other people are getting $27 worth of Wendy's before they get on the phone to Australia, you know, like if other people are experiencing this, there's some value to me talking about it, right? But I also don't think it didn't need to be named. There was this period where it didn't have a name and they were referring to it as like long haul COVID, like the extra long name. And I was like, just go ahead and call it eternal COVID because we don't know when this is going to end. Like we don't see an end point for this. But I thought, again, if I just describe the perceptions and the sensations, that's universal. It doesn't have to be called anything. People have had headaches historically. People have had mystic experiences. People have seen gorillas in the trees. And I'm going to speak to that aspect of human experience.
Mm. Our narrator tells us, I was going to write a masterpiece about being confused. and there is, you know, that changeling section, that is a section where things do get really weird, Patricia. You know, you're thinking about Gene Kelly and our butthole cats. You're thinking it feels like your wrists are broken, but they're not.
Yes,
you're dreaming
not.
You're a leaf. That whole section feels like this kind of extended fever dream. Can you talk to me about how you tackled that piece of writing?
Yeah, the changeling was like, I started writing this at the very beginning. I think I had that line, it stole people from themselves. You might look the same to others, but you had been replaced. I had it really early on. So it was in my head as a refrain. I knew I was going to write about it, but I was like, how exactly do I do that? And you know, hearing you say that about the dreaming you're a leaf, a large part of it was, you know, that I was like on forums, bulletin boards. We were like pooling our information at that time. We were exchanging remedies. I was like, hey, have you tried wormwood? Have you tried taking wormwood every morning like a witch from the Bible? That might work for you. But I think that was something that I was there for and not everyone was there for. And it was really so interesting that I was like, I'm going to put that down. If you can get at things through particulars, right, that just the little details that maybe other people might overlook or have forgotten, you really get at something. I don't want those things to be memory hold. I don't want it to just go away. It was still, that was 4 years of our lives, you know? It didn't just disappear into the ether. Like, it happened to us and it happened to all of us together.
And I was so glad to hear you say that you're feeling so much better now.
Yes, thank you.
Were there challenges in the actual writing process, or is that all okay for you at this point?
That looks a lot more normal. But if you look at the book, it's sort of like a document of me trying to figure that out and like understand how to write and how to do different kinds of writing, which is like kind of why the book contains different genres, right? I had to figure out how to do all of that again. But now it does feel more normal. I wrote a couple essays earlier this year. I would say the Simon Critchley essay that I wrote on his book, Mysticism, and the one about Sylvia Plath felt a lot more like me. It's one of those things where it's like, I might not recognize my face in the mirror, but you can recognize when your writing sounds like yourself and when you feel like you're back on your game again. That's kind of how I gauge things. It's a little bit superficial, but I'm not an athlete here. You know, my writing is all I have. That's the only way I can know.
last time you and I spoke, Patricia Lockwood, you were about to head off to the Booker ceremony for No One Is Talking About This.
There's
this really great tidbit in the book, and I want to know if it's true. So in the book, you say that you knew Damon Galgut was going to win because someone came and powdered his face, and only his face, right before the announcement happened.
Yep. Only his face. This is true. But actually, the insight is not mine. Jason was the one who realized. He was with me in that theater. So all of the finalists are sitting in the front row, and we're like, you know, it's like we're pooping bricks is the expression might go. It's a nerve-wracking situation. And this woman comes out. She's got a powder puff, and she sort of scans the line of us, and she zeroes in on him, and she powders his forehead. And Jason said, "That was how you knew he was going to win. She only powdered him." It was really like such a beautiful thing. And I didn't realize, I didn't understand that's what was happening. And he told me, he was like, "That's how you knew. She powdered him and him only." There's something later in that chapter. So a girl, Molly, asks a question about climate change, right? That's a little bit later on in this Artist is Present chapter. She actually came to the reading last night. She stood up. She asked another question. She said, "Do you remember the part in this book?" She says, "This is me. I asked that question. Now I'm 19. It was just that I got like goosebumps all over my body because I was like, whoa, books still mean something. People are still reading them. These like still constitute events in people's lives. Like we're still doing something with literature, you know?
I know it's a very particular experience to write a book about long COVID, but you had this incredible success with No One Is Talking About This. You were shortlisted for the Booker. That was your debut novel. What is the pressure to follow that up?
To me, it is honestly like, how do you break form? How do you make it interesting? How do you represent something as it actually was? You know, if you're writing a book about being crazy, going into the whirlwind, should it sound normal? Should it sound usual? Should it use like familiar narrative tropes? I didn't think so. So I'm always sort of like, I don't know, I'm pushing, I'm thinking about genre, but I'm really thinking just how do I get this down as it actually is? And that requires the invention of a different form every time.
Oh, I love what you do. It's so creative and so exciting. The latest book is called Will There Ever Be Another You? It's by Patricia Lockwood and it's published by Bloomsbury. Patricia, thank you.
Thank you so much. Go eat some Wendy's for me.
And speaking of the Booker, check out our Booker special for 2025, which we ran on the last episode of The Book Show. You can find it on the ABC Listen app. Now on The Book Show, we are starting something really fun. We are celebrating 250 years of Jane Austen. The anniversary of her birth officially takes place in December. And in the lead up, Sarah Lestrange and I are going to bring you a bunch of conversations with Janeites from around the world, talking about her life, her books, her legacy, and why authors still reach for her novels after all these years. The series is called Dear Jane. You're going to hear it here on The Book Show on ABC Radio National every week for the rest of the year. Or you can find the separate episodes in the ABC Listen app. Please do share them with the Jane Austen lover in your life. So to start today, let's look at the life of Jane Austen herself and bust some myths along the way. Sarah, did you know that Jane Austen kept notes of what people thought of her books?
Just the good reviews, I hope.
No, she seemed pretty happy to document the negative comments too. Apparently her mum told her that Mansfield Park was not as good as Pride and Prejudice and that she found the character of Fanny Price, that main character, insipid.
I have to say, I think both of those comments are fair.
Ouch. Well, Jane might write that down too. But today we're celebrating 250 years since the birth of Jane Austen, and I have called in a real expert, not just you and me, to talk about who Jane Austen really was. And to announce her, ding ding, please welcome Stone Cold Jane Austen to the track.
I'm Devonie Loser. I'm Regents Professor of English at Arizona State University. And I guess I get called a Jane Austen obsessive because most parts of my life are Austen saturated, including my sport, my hobby, roller derby, in which I often have skated as Stone Cold Jane Austen. So a mashup of the professional wrestler and my favorite author. But truly, Jane Austen has saturated every part of my life for a lot of years now.
When did you first fall in love with her?
Well, I think it was around age 13, and it didn't take immediately for me. I wasn't one of these immediately understood that this was my book and my person. My mother put the book in front of me several times. It was Pride and Prejudice that she put in front of me. And I think it was maybe the third time she kind of insistently put it before me that it finally started to seem funny to me. Like, I got the comedy. And once that happened, I was absolutely hooked.
Okay, Devonie, we've called you in as an expert on the life of Jane Austen. Can you start by running us through the vital stats as they were?
Yes. So Jane Austen was born on December 16th, 1775 in Steventon, which is a rural area in Hampshire, England. And she was the daughter of the Reverend George Austen, a clergyman, and Cassandra Lee Austen, who was known for her poems and her wit. So she had two very interesting parents, but they were not by any means a family of great wealth. They were what is sometimes called pseudo-gentry or low gentry. That means that they were not themselves landowners. Her father had to scramble in some ways to support what became a quite a large family of eight children. So she grew up in a very intellectual, I think, environment. But her father was always looking for some other way to add to the family's income. One of the ways he did this, interestingly, was by taking in male pupils. So there were, one scholar has estimated, 19 different boys who spent some years of their lives in this clergyman, Reverend George Austen's home. So in effect, Jane Austen didn't just grow up as a clergyman's daughter. She grew up in a boys' school, which is also just a bizarre way to imagine it, but in some regards true.
When did she start writing stories?
It's believed that she started writing around age 11, which is just a remarkably early age. The writings that survived from this period, she recopied at some stage. And so she cared enough about her tween years or, you know, her childhood writings. Sometimes they're called the juvenilia, her childhood writings. She cared enough about them that she recopied them. So we have access to these works, these earliest works of hers in her handwriting. And they've been published across the course of the 20th century. They didn't used to have a great reputation. They were seen as, you know, not maybe silly or lightweight, but I don't think they have that reputation anymore. I think you can see her brilliance, her genius in these works from 11, 12, 13 years old. It's quite incredible.
And was she writing along the themes that, you know, we know from her novels, marriage, romance, class, all of that sort of stuff?
Some of it, but in a very odd way. That is, she was doing send-ups of the stereotypes of fiction writing in her day. So if you would, you know, normally have a shipwreck and a surprise meeting of a long-lost father and daughter, she would include some of those features in her juvenilia, but it would be completely for comic effect.
There's also a story with cannibal children, right?
Yes, I love this. You don't expect there to be like a little light cannibalism in Jane Austen, but there is. And it's a mother who's been held in a private dungeon. And when she's released, she says she had reason to think her children might be hungry because they'd bitten off a few of her fingers. So yeah, there you go. Little light cannibalism in Jane Austen's teenage writings.
Light cannibalism in Jane Austen. I was not expecting that.
Yeah, it sounds like young Jane was having so much fun and getting so creative.
And some of this early work, it really sounds as though it's not that far away from Pride and Prejudice and Zombies, that adaptation that came out in 2009.
You're so right. I remember there was a bit of pearl clutching about that at the time, right? You know, this idea that, oh, Jane Austen would never. But maybe, Devonie Loser, a teenage Jane would have loved it.
I have argued exactly that, so I agree with you. We are on the same wavelength here. The juvenilia is filled with drunkenness, adultery, murder, not the things you necessarily associate with the mature Jane Austen, with the Jane Austen of the six major novels. But once you read the Juvenilia, you can see where she's coming from, and you can see where the comedy transformed, but includes some of these same elements that are riffing and making fun.
We're celebrating Jane Austen here on The Book Show, just in time for the 250th anniversary of her birth. I'm Claire Nichols, and over the next few episodes, we're going to explore Jane Austen's work and her legacy. Today, though, Sarah Lestrange, it's all about the life of the woman herself.
And it's just so fascinating to hear about her teenage writing. And while I'm not surprised that she was such a busy kid, I'm really surprised. She wasn't published until, what, the age of 35?
Yeah.
When this was Sense and Sensibility, when it was released.
Well, that wasn't for a lack of trying. Devani Losa, tell us, how hard had she tried to get published before this?
So we do know some things about her having tried to publish her work in the 1790s. We know that her father, for instance, tried to take a first novel out to a publisher and that it was rejected sight unseen. It was rejected by return of post. So it's not clear if that was Pride and Prejudice or if it was Sense and Sensibility. I think most people believe it was probably, quote unquote, First Impressions, which was the early version of Pride and Prejudice. So we know that she tried, and that in between that 1790s attempt and when the Sense and Sensibility was published in 1811, she did sell one novel. She sold a novel in 1803 for £10, and it's the novel that would later become Northanger Abbey. But oddly, the publisher who purchased it did not bring it out, paid £10 for it, and then didn't publish it. And so this has caused scholars a lot of confusion to try to figure out why would a publisher pay an author for it, but then neglect to publish it. But, you know, poor Jane Austen thought she was about to become an author in 1803, and it didn't happen. And it did finally occur in 1811.
And in the end, she went and bought back that Northanger Abbey manuscript, right?
I'm glad you asked about that, Claire, because this is such a delicious story, too. She wrote a letter to her non-publisher, Crosby, and said, you know, if you're not going to bring this book out, I would like you to return it to me. And she signed herself Mrs. Ashton Dennis, M-A-D. And you can see very clearly on the draft of this letter that she meant for them to see M-A-D, that she was mad. But yes, it ended up that they refused. They said, you know, if you want to pay us the £10, we'd be happy to let you have it back, but you need to refund the money we paid you. But we're not going to publish it. We purchased it and we're not publishing it. But she sent some years later her brother Henry back to Crosby, and he purchased it for £10 and then apparently had the delight of telling them, you just refused to publish a novel by the author of Pride and Prejudice. So they got the last laugh there.
Ha ha, victory for Jane.
I so love that story. And in the end, that first manuscript she sold, Northanger Abbey, I mean, it wasn't published until after Jane Austen's death at the age of 41.
Yeah, that's right. That and Persuasion both published after her death.
So Claire, I really want to know more about who Jane Austen was. Because what I know is that there's not that much on the public record, which must make it a really big challenge for experts like Devani Losa.
Yeah, there's about 160 letters remaining. The vast majority of her letters, though, were destroyed. We don't know exactly why. So when it comes to painting a picture of who Jane Austen was, often we have to rely on what other people said about her. And actually, her first biographer was her brother after her death.
Yeah, but what about looking at the books themselves? Maybe the stories tell us more about what mattered to Jane Austen.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And yeah, when you think about it, in all six major novels, the good triumph, the bad are punished. Our heroines always end up in the arms of the solid, dependable man. So, Devani, what do you think these stories tell us about the values of Jane Austen herself?
So this is where, having read hundreds of others that were published near, alongside, in the same era as hers, I think helps me see them a bit differently. I agree with you about the core and the ethics and the morality that's there. Clearly, she has a sense of what it means to be good. And her characters who do good and behave in ways that are good have better ends. So that is certainly a moral core. But she, I think, goes a little bit light on her villains. And I think she's responding to a very strong didactic moralizing tradition in her era that basically kills off the villain or, you know, sends them away like they're transported, like transportation, 19th century transportation, or execution, right? They die a tragic death because they're bad. She doesn't do that. She really lets her most flawed and villainous characters have a different kind of bad end. Often they're punished by being around other people who are really unpleasant to be around. And I think that too is a kind of morality, but it's not a punishment in the way that we generally think of it from fiction of this period. And you can see too that her heroines are not pictures of perfection. Their flaws are part of what make them interesting and arguably even good.
So we have the public reputation of Jane Austen, which I guess starts with her brother, right? He wrote the first biography of Jane Austen. In that, he calls her quiet, happy, faultless, tranquil. It sounds very lovely. It also sounds a little dull, Devaney. Do you believe that this is who Jane Austen was?
I don't. I think that first biographical notice by her brother Henry, which was written months after her death, so perhaps in his defense, it was written in a kind of hagiographic, she was a saint mode in a moment of grieving. So if we're going to give him a pass, that would be how we'd give him a pass. But yeah, this is silly. This is ridiculous. He says that her life was not a life of event. You know, this is obviously not true. And I think we can also tell from her letters that she was not someone who was boring and nice and faultless. She had a rapier wit and she wasn't afraid to use it, especially in private.
And you say in your new book that she was wild, Devaney. What makes Jane Austen wild?
I think this is to counteract the ways we've talked about her as so mild. I think mild is the wrong word to associate with her. I think so much more of what is going on in her writings and her life and her legacy deserves the term wild. And, you know, the subtitle to my book is A Rebellious, Subversive, and Untamed Jane. And I do think that these words go much more along with who she was, how she lived, and how she wrote. I'm not saying there was no mildness involved. Certainly, she was not the wildest person of her day. But there were things that she was doing that were really outside of what was proper. They were outside of what was conventionally feminine.
How wild was it to merely be a female novelist in this period of time?
Well, I think you're right, Claire. I think there is some sense in which we could say anyone who is a woman publishing her works during this period was already crossing a line. You know, the ideal woman was supposed to be passive and quiet and not unlike what Henry Austen describes in his biographical notice of her in 1818. You know, she was supposed to be so modest and never have any of her own ambitions. This is clearly not who Jane Austen was, and it's not really who any woman writer who brings her works to the public eye is. Already saying, I want a public to read this, is inviting a kind of scrutiny and seeing oneself as having something to say. And, you know, ambition is a word that I think has often negative associations with it, but I think Jane Austen was positively ambitious. She knew what she was doing was good, and she wanted readers. She wanted money, too.
Mild is out, Sarah. Wild is in.
I can get behind wild, Jane. But I'm thinking more about what Devaney just said about recognition. I wonder if Jane Austen really did want that recognition because she famously, well, she didn't put her name on her books in her lifetime.
Yeah, that's right. The author was a lady. Devaney Losa, how do you reconcile that?
Yeah, and so only the first one, Sense and Sensibility, was published by a lady in 1811. After that, very interestingly, and this was common, she was published not as by a lady in Pride and Prejudice, but as by the author of Sense and Sensibility. And each successive novel, she lets you link that novel back to ones that she did before. So in that sense, she wanted to be found, right? She wanted a readership that was going to be able to follow her from one novel to the next. Or maybe her publishers talked her into doing that, right? But I think the sense that the by a lady was the defining moment of her career is a bit overblown. Lots of novelists from this period first published their books without their names on them. But if the book was successful, often what they would do is go back in a later edition and acknowledge it. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if Jane Austen had lived if she would have put her name on these books. But I think that's an open question and at least possible.
Because only four had been published before her death, right?
That's right, yes. So
it was still early days.
Very early days. 1811 to her death in 1817, a lot had changed for her during that period. And although she did still have public anonymity in private, and not even that private, she was becoming well-known enough as the author of them that the Prince Regent himself knew who she was. So the Prince Regent was a notorious gossip, among other things, and a patron of the arts. So I think once the Prince Regent knows your identity, I think you can kind of assume that the cat's out of the bag. You know, it's not like they're just a handful of people who know that the author of Pride and Prejudice is Jane Austen. You know, there are probably quite a number of people who do, although I couldn't hazard a guess how many. It's definitely more than a handful.
Okay, you mentioned gossip. I do want to engage in a little bit of Jane Austen gossip, if you'll humour me. I think one of the most famous stories we know about Jane Austen is her engagement for one day. What do you know, Devaney, about this?
Yes, so this is, as you say, a famous story that there was a family friend, a younger man, as it happens. His name was Harris Big Wither. And it seems that the Austen family knew the Big Withers and that Jane and Cassandra knew Harris's sisters. So there was a time when Jane was visiting and Harris proposed to her and she said yes. And 24 hours later, she took back her yes and turned it into a no. So I think one of the reasons this story is so important is because often we want to say, oh, Jane Austen, she didn't have any opportunities to marry. So that when people are saying, look, she must have been somewhat desirable, somebody asked her. So I think this is one reason this story comes in, you know, to prove that she was desirable. That's a little sad, first of all, right? But I think the other thing about the story is that it shows us that she had some reluctance about what marriage meant. And I think it seems likely from what we know of her fiction that she wasn't in love with him. It would have been a good match. She would have had economic comfort. She would have taken herself off of the family balance sheet. So in that sense, it would have been a gift, an economic gift to her father and brothers. She put herself first by taking back her yes. And again, I think we can see at Pride and Prejudice some similarities to the ways Elizabeth Bennet makes her refusals known. Elizabeth Bennet's refusals, to me, seem much more like Jane Austen's acceptance than refusal, but that's a speculation too.
This has really changed my thinking on Jane Austen. I love the picture that Devaney has painted of this ambitious, wild woman who put herself and her work first.
Yeah, it's a bit different to that biographical note by her brother, right, about that faultless, tranquil woman. And Sarah, if you want to read more about Jane Austen's wild life, you can check out Devaney's book. It's called Wild for Austen. Devaney Losa, thank you.
Oh, Claire, thank you for shining a light on Jane Austen in this sester centennial year.
Thank you. And Sarah Lestrange, I'm going to try and use that word sesquicentennial as much as I can in the weeks ahead.
I'm glad you're saying it, not me. And there will be so many more opportunities to do so because we're going to keep this conversation going on Jane Austen, aren't we, Claire? Because next time, the fantastic Colm Tobin will give us some hints on how to read Pride and Prejudice.
Yeah, I can't wait for that. In the meantime, Sarah, I want to leave you with this line from Northanger Abbey.
The person, be it gentleman or lady, who has not pleasure in a good novel must be intolerably stupid.
Happy birthday, dear Jane.
You're listening to The Book Show on ABC Radio National, where let's finish by celebrating the book that came in at number 2 in our recent Top 100 Books countdown, seemingly against the odds.
And I thought, what if someone reads it and they do actually like it and they try to recommend it to their friend and the friend says, oh, well, what's it about? And you go, well, it's set in Nazi Germany. It's narrated by death. Nearly everyone dies. Oh, and it's 580 pages long. You'll love it.
That is, of course, Marcus Zusak talking about his beloved 2005 novel, The Book Thief. The novel is about Liesel, a feisty German girl who finds power in stealing books. And it was inspired by Marcus's parents' stories of their experiences in Europe during World War II. It's a novel of big ideas and huge creative risks, including, yes, death as the narrator.
Well, pretty much the best things never just are preordained in a lot of ways. I mean, some ideas start to work and go, oh, that's really working now from the sheer force of will. But a lot of the really great ideas that sing kind of just happen. And in this case, I was working at a high school and I had these kids who were really keen on writing. And so at lunch, once a week, we sat and did some writing. I just sat with them and I said, here's a first line to a story. Yeah, the lazy teacher's trope, you know, of, here, I'm going to give you a first line, you guys write. And so I did that and I wrote with them. And the line was this, I still remember it. And it's a kind of over-the-top, lame first line to a story, which is, I've seen the colour of time on 3 occasions. That was the line. And I wrote with them and I wrote 3 really short, you know, kind of like half a page excerpts. So it was a page and a half. And maybe a bit longer. And I'd written about 3 deaths and I'd written from the point of view of death. And they mentioned colours, which were red, white and blue. And I went, you know what, maybe I'll just throw that idea into that book that I'm setting in Nazi Germany and where the girl, I'm thinking of using that other idea I had about a girl stealing books in modern day Sydney. And so I just threw those 3 ideas together, the stories of my mum and dad and where that could possibly go. All of a sudden, I had this interesting mix of ideas. And when I had the girl stealing books, I wasn't even thinking of book burnings. I wasn't even thinking of Goebbels and propaganda and Hitler and how they used words. Nothing of that. It's sort of like you're waiting for things to come into focus. First, you just throw down these big buildings in the background or in the foreground, and you hope that at some point you'll be able to see them. And so in a way, I talk about it casually because it was casual the way it came up, but then getting it to work was another. And so I wrote with death as a narrator and then I read over it. And when I read it, I went, oh my God, it's like after every page, I need to go and have a shower or something. It was like death was so awful, so sardonic and sadistic. He was really enjoying his work, you know. And so I did this extreme about face and got Liesel to narrate. And then I went, oh, this is even worse. Now I've got, despite my German and Austrian background, I've got the most Australian-sounding German girl in the history of books. And then I went to third-person narration. So I went, this is everything that I was trying to avoid. And it just took that one little adjustment. And I think when you've done a lot of work, when you've put the effort in, then you come back and you realise, oh, it just takes a little adjustment. And the little adjustment that I made was I thought of the last line of the book and I went, oh, that's how you write it. Death is actually quite vulnerable. He likes humans and he's kind of a bit in awe of humans, and especially for that we can be capable of such beauty but such destruction. And he's telling this story to prove to himself that humans are actually worthwhile. And I had this, all of these carcasses of work, you know, to pick from, and then I started and I rewrote. And then I had the idea of how to do it, to tweak the language to make it exactly right, and then I didn't stop.
Of course, having a novel narrated by death means we know from the start a lot of people we love are going to meet this guy. Like, we are going to lose a lot of these characters we care about right from the start.
Mm.
It's tough.
Yeah, it's got to happen. People are going to die. But what I really enjoyed was Death saying things like, look, I'm just going to tell you, look, Rudy, he's probably your favourite character, but he's going to die halfway through the book. And then he goes on to say, you know what, mystery bores me, it chores me. And even that little play on words, I had so much fun writing this book. Even the ending where people say, God, that must have killed you to write that ending. And I say, yeah, it did. But God, I was so alive when I was writing that ending and I was so happy. And then when people say, oh, you killed Rudy, it's my favorite. Yeah. And I say, Rudy is my favorite character that I've ever written. And not for one second did I consider letting him live. And people go, oh my God, you're like you're a monster. And I say, yeah, but here's the thing. If I'd let Rudy live, I wouldn't love him as much. And you do what's right for the character, but you'd more do what's right for the book. By letting people know halfway through that he's going to die, it was an idea of, I'm just preparing you.
Giving you a little hug and letting you know, well, it's coming.
It's both a big slap, as in, what? Just being told this character's going to die. But also everything Rudy does that's great after that moment, rescuing Liesl's book from the river when it gets thrown in by that jerk imitating the hammer throw of the Olympic, you know, winner or the discus winner who throws her book in the river and Rudy gets it. Going in and getting a suit from his dad's shop and every other little thing that Rudy, putting the teddy bear on the dying, you know, soldier's chest in the plane. All of these things, like they all add, it adds more weight knowing that he's going to die.
I want to talk a little bit about the story itself. So our main character is Liesl. She's a German girl living through the Second World War. She lives in a town called Molking with her foster parents. And her big rebellion is that she's a thief. She steals books. Her fingers itch for them. And when we first meet her, she can't read yet, but it's still books that are calling out to her. Why books?
Yeah, I don't know, to tell you the truth. As articulated by Rudy when she's stealing a book from the mayor's wife's library, he's like, just see if there's some food.
Yeah.
And get something useful. And I think thematically books were so important. This idea that, you know, what do we feed our souls with if not artworks and books and stories and the lives of the people around us. You know, we're really made of our stories. I did realise then at some point that this was a really good metaphor for that time, that, you know, Hitler was destroying people with words. Actually, I didn't think this at the time. I think you learn a lot about a book after you've finished it and you start talking about it. You know, and the more interviews like this, you sort of go, oh, that's what it's about. But I realised that if someone was to say, what's the book thief about? I'd forget all the, you know, this and that and this is what happens. I just say, it's about the idea that in Nazi Germany, Hitler destroyed people with words. And this is a story about a girl who's stealing the words back. Mm. And she's writing her own story with those words. And it's a beautiful story, hopefully, written amongst that ugly world. To me, it matched up to that time. Books had made my life, and so it was, for me, it just made sense that in, you know, even you think of Nazi Germany too and you think of Hitler and you think of Mein Kampf, and that was an idea where I sort of went, oh, I can use Mein Kampf. And that's how you start. You start not quite knowing what you're doing. And that's the other thing with writing, is you got to be prepared to spend a lot of time in the dark, like trying to find the light switch. And so you start to, yeah, you're just stitching together these ideas, waiting for extra light bulb moments to happen.
Marcus Suzak, he spoke to me at the start of the year about his extraordinary novel, The Book Thief, and you can find that longer interview on the ABC Listen app. Just look for The Book Show. While you're there, you can also listen back to all the highlights from our Top 100 Books Countdown, where The Book Thief did indeed come in at number 2. To find those highlights, just search for Top 100 Books. The Book Show is made on the lands of the Wurundjeri and Whadjuk Noongar people. Thanks this week to producers Anita Barrow and Sarah Lestrange and to operator David LeMay. I'm Claire Nichols. Ben Elton is going to join me next week, and we'll have more Jane Austen too. Talk then.